Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean.
And on today's episode, we discuss the 2023 Oscar winner, The Zone of Interest. Chris is very much in the camp that this film is a modern masterpiece, while Travis, well, he needs some convincing. They discussed sound design, slow cinema, and the film's ultimate commentary on cultural apathy.
Travis, have you ever been walking a hallway and you suddenly like look to your right and you're launched 50 years into the future?
I thought you were going to say look to your right and see the ghost of Paul Buchanan, which has definitely never happened to me. But no, the other thing hasn't happened to me either.
Paul Buchanan?
Yeah.
I don't even know who that is.
He's just a singer.
Yeah, wait, I just looked it up. Are you talking
he's
about
alive.
The Scottish Glasgow-based songwriter and musician known for critically acclaimed compositions, both as a co-founder and of the Blue Nile?
He's not dead, so why would I see his ghost? That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's your point. What I had no idea that when I started this bit, it would go in this direction.
Well, that's the kind of bit partner you got here. Wild card.
Ah, yes, the wild card.
But anyway, you were saying going through time. I mean, have I traveled through time? That's a different question. But your specific situation, no, has never happened to me.
I guess the time travel conversation is one for a different movie.
Yeah, when we cover Primer, isn't that a time travel movie?
I've never seen Primer.
I haven't either. And everyone says it's one of those movies you're supposed to write about if you're explaining movies. But I guess we'll save that for another day.
Yeah, we refused for too
long. But anyway, hallways, traveling through time. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. We talked about starting this with complete silence, but that's not good for a podcast to just have... like 2 minutes of silence and be like, aha, that's the bit because of the movie.
Well, yeah. If you want to make a statement,
which is what
this podcast is all about.
Yeah. It probably would have been a better somber opening for Zone of Interest than jokes about hallways and Paul Buchanan.
Yeah. But here we are.
Yeah. Here we are indeed. Zone of Interest, a movie that I've been excited to talk about since I saw it, I think like January 9th, I got to see her January 12th, and I've been in love ever since.
Nice, yeah. Did you see it? Was Jonathan Glazer at your screening?
He wasn't at the screening,
but okay.
The guy who founded the Alamo Drafthouse, Tim League, was in Los Angeles and interviewing him.
Okay.
And they did a live feed to all of the Alamo Drafthouses that were showing the movie.
Got it, okay.
So... he was there on screen, but he wasn't there like physically.
But still, you saw it live. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because a lot of the articles that have been written after, or even watching it on Prime, they do the X-ray thing on the side. And it sometimes has interesting bits, but it had one long, like really long quote from Jonathan Glazer about the meaning of the movie and why he made the movie. And it was it's like taken from the thing that I was listening to.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gets pretty explicit.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't being very Kubrick about it and being like,
no.
You know, you figure it out.
Or David Lynch, like, I'm not going to tell you. You do it. You do the work.
Yeah. I made it. You figure it out. No, he's just like, this is very much about like the things that we're capable of. And it's not just about the past, but it's about like human nature and is as applicable to the present as it is to what was going on in Germany.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is powerful. I think that's one of the difference makers of this movie. Because, I mean, Holocaust movies are inherently usually very emotional and very powerful experiences. Mm-hmm. Even ones that kind of get criticized a little bit. Like, Boy in the Striped Pajamas is definitely somebody's favorite Holocaust movie. But I think if you're comparing it to, like, Night and Fog, Schindler's List, just some of the other Holocaust movies out there, Boy in the Striped Pajamas is a little bit like, that's nice of you. But that was one that like punched me in the stomach so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Where I saw it with a friend in college. We went to a screening in Cleveland with a whole bunch of Jewish people. It was being put on, like being screened by like a Jewish group in Cleveland. And I think the average age of the people watching the movie was like 80 years old. And then just me and a friend,
right,
like the lone college people. And the emotion in the theater as the movie was going on, just because you could feel how many people either had memories from like personal experience of being young and in a concentration camp or in Germany, like survivors, or were directly related to somebody who had survived and grew up hearing about it, knowing about it, had family involved in it. It just made the experience very palpable, to where I had to go give like a Greek life speech afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And I was standing up in front of a room of people trying to talk and having to stop and be like, I'm sorry, I'm 30 minutes removed from seeing a Holocaust movie that just kicked me in the stomach, and I was crying all the way home, and now I still want to cry. So it's like, it's such a powerful genre of film, especially because we are still so close to it, and still human nature wise see, I think, the seeds of the behaviors that could make a Holocaust possible. As much as we want to think we're beyond something like that ever happening again, we're not. And that's really awful to confront. But so many of the Holocaust movies I've seen are just about the past. This is the first one that I feel like personally I've watched that makes me think about the present and that reality of the situation of, this is not something that's relegated to the past, but something that's very much a part of the now, in a way that gives it a vitality and a meaning and a posture that really strikes me.
Yeah, actually, I want to dig into that because I'm still processing my feelings about this movie a little bit. Like, I have an immediate reaction to it that is, I feel like there's part of me that's wondering if I'm being too cynical or too, like, maybe a little too obtuse. And there's just more of a concrete takeaway from this movie I can get. So I guess to you, what is the key takeaway then? Like, if the idea is, so this movie is set up where we're watching this family exist in this nice idyllic home, leading a pleasant life, all while mayhem is happening right outside the walls, and it's becomes this commentary on like what we ignore, especially with the ending being the way it is. It's very pointed and direct about it. What is the ultimate point then, do you think, of this movie? That is it purely just we can't just live our lives, like I can't just go around my house and raise my kids and have a job and ignore like the atrocities happening in the world or like what's happened in the past? Is it purely commenting on that, just kind of like the everyday ignorance, or is it a larger commentary on something bigger? You know what I mean? Like, is it because like it's one thing for people to just like have apathy and to just be a little ignorant, blissfully ignorant, but it's a whole other conversation if we're talking about like what produces like these massive forces of evil, you know? Like, And maybe that's the trouble I'm having with this movie, is like where that connection is, and ultimately, like, what is the movie commenting on? Is it on both, or is it just on like the smaller thing where it's just us?
Yeah, I would say that it's mostly the smaller thing, but that leads into the larger thing, if that's, which seems unsatisfying as an answer, but
right. Well, I do think that is the answer, so go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. The smaller thing, in the sense, is commenting on both this idea of human nature and this ability that we have to limit our zone of interest, which the title is kind of fascinating because the book that this is derived from or adapted from, the title refers specifically to the fact that this area where the administrators lived was called the zone of interest. I think a little ironically, if I remember, just because that's where a lot of the drama was going on for the people who worked at the camp. So it was essentially like the zone of interest because that's like the gossip, the happening, kind of the melodrama of life behind the scenes of a concentration camp. And it gets into this love triangle between the commandant's wife and a guard. So you get the family that's living close by, but the love triangle doesn't exist in the movie at all. Right. And you never really get reference to the group as a whole. It's just this house. So I think the title shifts a little bit under Glazer in that it goes from being about this area where the administrators lived to referring more poetically to the idea of the things that we pay attention to and the things that we choose not to pay attention to, which they demarcate in the movie with the visuals being so idyllic and family-driven, while the audio is so awful and terrifying and sad and frightening throughout. And the ability that we see the family have to ignore that for the most part. But you have to wonder the ways in which it's actually affecting them and impacting them. So I think there's a main point, and this is something that Glazer himself talked about, was this idea of the things that we choose to ignore in order to live our lives. And how much closer we are to being the people enacting the Holocaust than we like to think, due to the fact that so many of us will justify turning our interest to something else. So one example that stands out, living in a major city, the thing that you see all the time, especially increasingly, is the issue with homelessness and unhousedness and the struggle of so many. I think they said in Austin, the population of unhoused is around 5,000, which is the size of my hometown. Like, my hometown of Canal Fulton, Ohio is 5,000 people. So it's like everybody I knew growing up as a child, take them and put them as homeless in Austin. Yeah. That's insane. Like, that's insane to think about. But you have a million people here who just exist without really thinking about that, or even if they do have flashes of it, see it, they quickly put it out of their minds. And that's just like a relatively like casual example of that. It can ramp up in terms of the things that we choose to ignore, like US military efforts, right? Overseas and in other countries, like the amount of stuff that the country does that we decide that we don't want to know about or care about. There are these ways in which all of us in some degree are ignoring things that would morally like upset us and that we disagree with in order to just live our lives. But the fact that what happened with the Holocaust is that scaled up so dramatically and so intensely. And so we like to think that we're morally superior to the Haas family, but the movie is designed in so many ways to make us realize how much similar we are to them, which is made very clear in the opening scene when you just see them swimming and they don't have clothes on. They just have like bathing suits. So they just, they're unadorned and in that way, very humanized and could be anybody that you know, like any family doing anything. But then the very next scene, the next morning, you see the dad come down in the Nazi officer uniform. And whatever initial kindness you felt for these people takes a grim turn as you realize this is a Nazi like officer. And what's that mean? You can't have the same feelings that you had for them because you now realize that they're doing this horrible thing. And that continues to develop over the course of the movie, especially with Hedwig. So there's something to that in the pricking of consciousness that this movie is supposed to have. Mm-hmm. Instead of us being able to feel so morally superior to the Nazis, like we'd never do anything like that. It's kicking us in the shin a little bit and saying, hey, in some ways you do this every single day.
Yeah.
Which ties into some of the banality of evil. Mm-hmm. That was such a big conversation point coming out of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Because so much of the impression that people had was that all of the Nazis had to have been these like unmitigated psychopaths that delighted in the torment and like killing and awfulness that was going on, when in reality a lot of them were just in quotes following orders and not really thinking about it and mm-hmm. really disengaged from the humanity of it all. And so the evil was very banal. It was very kind of boring and plain. And the disinterest is almost what made the whole thing possible, was that
right.
people just didn't care. So there's something to that as well in like some of the larger evils of it. It's not just the zone of attention, but it's also not fighting back, not pushing back, not having this emotion that allows for this thing to grow and become so like malignant.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah. I do want to come back at some point to this whole idea that we're closer to the Haas family than we realize, but I do think you're hitting on something in the movie that works really well is this examination of these people and how complacent they become and how natural it is to them. Like from the people doing the terrible things, like the people working for Hitler, the higher up people who are crafting, like the boring conversation they have about improving the gas chambers, you know, or the yeah. furnace system. Like the fact that we spend so long just listening to that, like I like that. Like I thought that was a really powerful moment that highlighted just like how banal it is. And it's done in the style that I really, that I've always gravitated towards. Like I had a period where I really liked, you know, experimental movie like Marguerite Duras or Chantal Ackerman. Like to me, this movie had mad Ackerman vibes, like Gene Dielman or what's the movie I love that I can't even think of? Well, whatever. Gene Dielman is a good example. But then like, you know, Bellatar makes movies like that. And even Apichatpong makes movies yeah. like this, the kind of like slow cinema. I think it's such a great style of film, a great technique. If you just want someone to steep in the moment and what is, it's a risk not a lot of movies take. And I always like a movie trying that out. And I think this movie like succeeds in that way. Like, you know, from those guys to like the kids, mm-hmm. just being able to hear what's going on in the background and with them being contrasted with the mom who like realizes the horror of what's happening. Like it's a cool exploration of how numb we can become to it and how like years in this earth can make us just like we could be almost just we become hollow towards it almost. It's a really cool, I just think that whole dynamic of the movie and exploring this family, like that's probably what I found most interesting about it. I might have some problems with the parallels he's making to like us and like modern times and stuff, but as far as like the movie itself and its characters and its exploration, like I think it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And I, you know, if you didn't admire those things, I feel like I wouldn't even know who you were. I'd be like, who is Travis anyway? Have I known anything about him? Do I understand him even a little bit?
I mean, the Apicha Pot thing was the biggest thing for me. Like I was watching it thinking like, this reminds me of Syndromes in a Century. Like I haven't seen a movie do this in a long time.
Right.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
I mean, rewinding a little bit, for Glazer movies, I've only watched the one, which is Under the Skin. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched Sexy Beast or Birth. And we did a podcast episode on Under the Skin. We kind of talked about the fact that it took both of us a while to kind of come around on it.
Yeah. Which, and I'm still not totally sold on it, but I hate it less than I used to.
Yeah, where I've come around on actually really liking and respecting it. It just took a while to get into some of the commentary on humanity and the human experience. And I don't think it's a perfect movie, but there was a beauty to it that I now finally can appreciate. So I was very interested to see what he was going to do next, especially because it's been 10 years since he had made.
He needs 10 year breaks between his movies.
Yeah. Don't we all? Yeah. Birth was 2004. And then at the screening, Tim Lee did an intro via satellite feed, but he was saying that he thought this movie was a masterpiece. And I had it's not quite the same experience that I had with There Will Be Blood. Because when I watched There Will Be Blood, I didn't like it at first, which is insane. But I liked this. I wasn't sold on masterpiece level the first like 72 hours. Like, I thought it was very good and could see myself coming around. It's just I kept thinking about it for days and days afterwards. And writing about it helped as well, but it's one of those movies that I've thought about so much since I saw it, and it just hasn't left my mind. So as the days turn to weeks, turn to a couple months, the idea that it's a masterpiece has like very seriously taken hold and flowered in my mind. So,
yeah, it sounds like it really made you think a lot about yourself and like look at everyone around you and just how society, there's more evil and and more atrocities than ever these days. Like it must make you like look at all that and how our reactions to all that.
Yeah, there's just something like I admire the mission of trying to remind people that this isn't something that happened. It's something that is part of human nature that we need to keep top of mind. It's not an anomaly that just occurred. It's a recent example of something that is inside of humans. And I don't think he's necessarily not condemning people in the sense of, you idiots, you're all calm in your houses while these atrocities are going on. I think it's a lot more analytical or scientific than that, of just exploring the fact that this is an aspect of who we are and trying to make people aware of that so they can take away from it what they will. And as bleak as the movie is, having that contrast of the girl who goes around and puts food out mm-hmm. for people, and those like thermal images that really turn around the color palette and just the visuals of the film, I think highlights some of the beauty that Glazer sees in humanity, that even if this ugliness is present, and even when it's the dominant state of the human condition in a period of time in a group of people, that there's always going to be the person who leaves an apple.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is almost the more powerful statement that the movie makes.
Yeah.
Which I like a lot. So yeah, I went into it like hoping for something great, and I came out of it very excited by it, thinking that this is probably the best movie I've watched since There Will Be Blood.
Yeah. I went into it, you know, honestly, I didn't know much about it. I knew the basic plot. I guess that's all the movie is. The movie is super basic. So like, as soon as you find out what it's about, like, you kind of know what it's about. But I didn't necessarily know what the commentary was. And I luckily, though, I had an in just because of Jonathan Glazer's speech at the Oscars. Like, he kind of there even spells out a little bit what the movie's about and mm-hmm. what the big takeaway is. So I knew going in that aspect of it. And I will say that that whole mindset, like the whole banality of evil, like, I get it on some levels and think it's true on some levels. I think a lot of what you were saying about people just following orders, like, I totally see that and understand it. But I do also think sometimes when people use that argument, like, it always strikes me as a little, it strikes me as very cynical, I guess. Like, it seems very concerned with a very abstract view on human nature, on this idea that we all have like a fascist in us, which, again, I understand on a certain level. Like, I see what that's getting at, but I also think it's a lot more complicated than that, and that there are historical and social circumstances that drive people to this point. And not just masses of people, like, there's always like one person who gets driven to that point, and he convinces like a bunch of people to, like, I guess that's what I always think when discussing or thinking about topics like this, like the banality of evil and what Jonathan Glazer is positing in this movie, is that, like, isn't it more complicated than this? Like, on some level, I get what he's saying, and I understand that, you know, if people don't want to read about what's happening in Gaza, if people don't want to know about that and they just want to live their lives, like, yeah, of course those people exist. But I guess what I'm missing is this, how we make that connection to the really bad people, the people who built those furnace chambers, the people that were watching in this movie, like, am I connected to them really? I'm just talking through stuff right now. Like,
yeah.
That was like kind of my thought going into the movie, like, is that what this movie's doing? And then, like, it became pretty clear that was what the movie was doing. I do think the ending's good. Like, it does, like, it brings everything full circle in a very artistic way, but it's also like a really obvious thing to do. Just like the soundtrack of this movie, the sound design in this movie is a little obvious. Like, it's clear, like, the connections it's constantly trying to make. I think that's kind of my big takeaway from the movie, is like, I wish I could have liked it on the level you're liking it, but like, the points it's making feel both not complicated enough and like too direct. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like there's so many like episodes that we've done where you're like, I want things spelled out for me a little bit more. Like, I'm a dummy. Just like, give me the information that I need.
And I can speak on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Where does this land in terms of that?
Yeah. So I think usually when I make that self-deprecating kind of joke, it's in terms of like, I want fuller, richer situations and characters. Like, I want to be made to feel about something. You know what I mean? Like, I want a situation to be enlivened, to have flamboyancy, for there to be color. And like, I don't need like the message screamed at me, but I also don't want it to be like hidden. And I don't want the movie to be ploying. I want to be like included in the experience in that way. Like, I want to have a deep investment with the characters. I want to be standing there right beside them and like understanding the situation as they do, which again, I think this movie does. But I think I do have a little bit, and this is maybe just more of a subjective thing. Like, I do get a little annoyed about movies that become too direct. And I think it's a very modern technique. Like, I'm thinking of Tar and how like, you put the ghost in the room or something like that, or this need to have a really long take to make you, I don't know. Sometimes they're just like certain techniques people use that feel like a little dull and Neanderthalish to me. Like, it's such a simple way to like make this point. And the Zone of Interest kind of dips into that territory with the sound design. Like, I like it as a decision ostensibly just because like it highlights a point the movie's trying to make, but it's also just like so obvious and simple. I don't know, like, it works and it doesn't work to me, because it is hearing the screams of women and children, and you know, it's effective in a way because like you're forced to hear something that like you might have been ignoring your whole life, but in like the artistic realm, the fact that it's so obvious is the thing that gets me, I guess. That's the simplest way I can put it.
Yeah, I guess my pushback on that would be that it's part of a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that aspect of it is very direct, but it's part of this, like, setting the foundation for a larger discussion on the human condition and human capacity, right, for this, that, and this other thing. So it's like, if it was the main theme, I feel I'd be inclined to like agree more with it as like a strike or like a negative.
Mm-hmm.
But as like part of a larger like a larger universe of discussion, or part of a, like a multi-step thematic, like,
yeah, right,
statements, I feel like you're going to have some aspects that are a bit more direct or one-dimensional, but you add them together and what, yeah, they're saying is a little more complex in how it's operating.
It's funny, you're sitting here saying it all that, and like, I agree with all that, and I'm sitting here like, I don't really have a problem with the sound in the movie. I think my reaction, I realize it as I'm sitting here, is like, it won for sound design at the Oscars and it became such a talking point politically that it kind of annoyed me. I think that was the big thing about this movie, and really was a disservice to this movie, is just the language people have had around it. And like, I don't know. I mean, people care about this movie and they're passionate about it, and that's a good thing. Like, I don't want to discourage that. But I guess maybe this is more of a subjective take, is that I don't necessarily think this movie is doing things leagues beyond what other movies have done. It's certainly doing it in a different way. Like, there's not a lot of people using this slow cinema format these days. Based on like what the movie is and the kind of observations it's making about humanity, like, I guess I'm just on some level where I'm just not seeing how it's so much more deep and complex than what other movies are capable of doing. Like, but I also like Michael Bay movies, so what the fuck do I know?
Yeah, what's a movie in comparison that you think is like a better example of what people are talking about, or fits the way people are talking about this movie better than this movie actually does?
Do you mean like a specific observation this movie's making, or just any observation any movie would make?
Just in general, as you're talking about like how people are talking, like Me Too, like how we have been talking about this movie and what it's doing. Like, is there a movie that's like, that movie's actually on the level of what you're talking about?
I don't mean to make it like a political argument. I'm not even really referring to like the politics of the situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of like the filmmaking storytelling.
Yeah. Well, we're on the topic of Michael Bay. Like, I watched The Ambulance and...
God damn it.
I found it fascinating. I thought it was just the way... Again, we're talking about artistic techniques that filmmakers use to make their ultimate point. I guess someone's already shaking their head like, what point could Michael Bay be possibly making? But if you've seen Pain and Gain, you knew
the person.
Haven't you seen Pain and Gain?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the one that tried getting you to watch it for years.
Do you think that movie's not making a point about the American dream? And
oh, yeah, yeah. 1,000% it is.
So that kind of stuff is all, and in Pain and Gain, it's, I would say that commentary is pretty direct in terms of the actual situation of like the comedy of all that crazy shit happening to them. But, you know, in something like Ambulance, it becomes this love letter to LA and kind of like navigating the city as we go through this traumatic situation and as these people burn through the city. Like, it's a cool, purely the way it's filmed is cool and different and enlivened. Like, it moves at a manic pace and is trying to keep up with the characters, like, it's that are running through the city and like trying to keep in step with them and what they're going through. Like, there's something so inherently beautiful and passionate about the connection between the camera and the people in a way that, like, it's constantly thumping and like it just like it to me, like, I don't know how you couldn't watch them like that and like be captivated and have it not grab you. But people aren't saying that about Ambulance. You know, they're saying all the things that I always say about Michael Bay. I guess if you want an example of really crazy example of, like, you know, I look at what people are saying about Zone of Interest and I'm like, well, yeah, but all the stuff you're saying that it's doing well, like, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? Like, it's not bad. Like, obvious isn't like terrible, I guess. Like, the sound design of this movie is well done, but like, let's face it, like, it's kind of obvious what it's doing. It's just that, like, that's not really part of the discussion. There's just a lot of idolizing going on in a way that, like, is it done for other movies that are doing just as much work? So, again, this is just me coming with a chip on my shoulder. Like, I'm not ragging on the sound design of this movie, but I do find it weird that, like, people are so captivated by it, but not other things other movies do, which are way more interesting, in my opinion.
So you would say that what's going on in Ambulance is way more interesting than what's going on in Zone of Interest?
As far as the commentary of the movie, yeah.
Fascinating.
Definitely.
Fascinating. Infuriating. Fascinating.
I mean, I think you could argue Zone of Interest. I mean, they both have, obviously Michael Bay has a stylistic presence, but like, they both have their own very indulgent styles. You could argue that Zone of Interest is just more interesting visually. But again, I'm just speaking to the commentary of the movie.
Speaking to the commentary of the movie?
Yeah. Like, yeah, isn't that what we're talking about? Like, you asked me if I think Ambulance has a more interesting commentary in the Zone of Interest. Like, I think it does, purely because the filmmaking of the movie enlivens what's... It brings more... I just think the commentary is more complex, basically. Like, the sound design in Zone of Interest, I think it's kind of one note in a way. Like, I get what you mean. Like, it's part of the bigger whole and it's part of something that's building. But once you know what this means, like, that's kind of it, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was something on the, like, watching it, I was like, I feel like one of Travis's issues is going to be that you get the same kind of beats a few times. Like, you see the kid playing with his toy soldiers and you're hearing the atrocities in the background. You see the mother-in-law or the mom, the grandma, trying to sleep and she hears the atrocity in the background. They're having the party and you hear the atrocity in the background. It's like there's not much that's different between each of those three scenes aside from what's going on in the foreground. So do you need it more than the one time? Or does it just start to lose power on repetition?
It's part of the atmosphere of the movie. Like, again, I get it. I'm not trying to rag on it at all. We just got into a discussion of, like, people's reaction to it. That's really what I'm commenting on.
Well, yeah, but I'm part of the group that's had the very positive. I haven't. Right. I just finished saying that I haven't seen a movie this good since There Will Be Blood. So I'm very much part of that group that's lauding it over other movies.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's to me because I feel like I see movies like Ambulance a lot more often, whether maybe not in the exact style that Michael Bay would do it, but like close enough to where it doesn't feel special to me in a way. It feels what I would expect from an action, like an action thriller kind of movie. Or, I mean, which is a lot of Hollywood right now. I feel like there's a lot of sameness in terms of what you're getting from each blockbuster, what you're getting from each like indie horror film, what you're getting from the Oscar contenders, to where I don't think I've seen. And, you know, maybe people are making movies like Zone of Interest and I'm just not watching enough of them. Like the same way that I missed The House That Jack Built. That's a movie that's, I think, closer to the Zone of Interest than a lot of other movies in terms of being like slower, a bit more bold in some of the choices that it's making and big in what it's exploring. But to me, the thing that makes Zone of Interest stand out is, as you identified, the slow cinema aspect of it. The sound design, while straightforward, or even what was the word that you had used? Obvious in terms of like what it's doing. Like, I didn't mean that sarcastically. I couldn't remember the word. Obvious in what it's doing. It's still one of those things that I don't recall seeing that kind of contrast used so powerfully, maybe like much at all, if I'd heard it used before. Like the foreground background visuals, yes, foreground background audio in that way, it's not something that I think of as like a common technique. So despite like the obviousness of it, there is still something that feels inventive to me about it. And I'm a sucker for the kind of cinematography that this movie has. The long shots, the wide shots a lot of the time, giving like the actors room to kind of be present on screen and really steep in what they're doing on screen. And I really love a lot of the just beats. Like you have the two brothers that are in bed and the one's not asleep and asks like, what's the other one doing? It's a very like a very tropey kind of scene that you would see in like a lot of coming of age films, except what the kid's looking at isn't a comic book or a stolen magical item that's going to lead them on a treasure hunt. It's gold teeth from these people who have been killed. There's something, there's beats like that that happen a number of times, but each one is just a little different to me that it feels powerful. So I don't know, just seeing the Apichapong of it all works for me because it's not something I see a lot of people attempting, and much less doing with something so literary and so and reinventing the genre in some way in terms of how the genre is exploring the topic.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you.
I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Yeah, it's definitely a new take. I mean, again, the takeaway is so pointed and specific that like it becomes its own thing. Like it becomes almost like an art piece, like an art installation. That was one thing I kind of thought about this movie, is like the point this movie's making could be done in like a much shorter amount of time, like using all the same techniques, which was part of my problem with the movie. Like it's hour 45 minutes and like, does the sound design become more and more like dramatic and hits you harder and harder as the movie moves along, or does it start of like kind of start to drag? That's, I guess, up to whoever's watching it. I didn't really, it didn't start to get to me until the very end, but I just did have that thought of like, this movie is ultimately making a very simple point in a very elongated way, which is okay. Like I like slow cinema and I can sit with the movie for a while, but I did wonder if there was just like simpleton me coming out again, like a way to like get me a little more invested in it, you know, like kind of hit me in the stomach a little bit, which I think the end does a little bit better with him like looking at all the German people in the room and him like walking down the hallway and wanting to puke, like but still but sorry, did you have anything in reaction to everything I just said?
Just that I find it funny that you're saying it felt long when it's like done before an hour 38.
It did feel long though to me.
It's a relatively short film, especially compared to like a lot of other things that we've
to a Michael Bay movie
talked about. How long's Ambulance?
It's probably like 2.5 hours, but that movie doesn't feel 2.5 hours. That's my point.
Crazy.
But anyway, I want to speak to though what you were saying about this movie feeling unique in terms of its sound design, and that like you don't usually notice movies, like you don't notice the sound design of movies. Is that essentially what you're saying?
No, I notice the sound design in movies. I'm thinking specifically about the contrasting between the foreground and the background, and the idea of having this idyllic kind of foreground while the background is this like capturing the horrors of what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Specifically that idea of contrast in the sound design to create that effect.
And I guess my point is the very fact, not the fact that there is contrast, but that the contrast is so pointed and like, that's it. Like, I don't have a problem with that. Like, that is a choice a movie makes. I would argue that that's not any, everyone's talking about the sound design of this movie and not about the sound design of any other movie is my point. And that decision that that movie makes to use the sound design in that way, like, that isn't, in my opinion, deeper or more complicated than any other movie that's has well employed sound design, including, here we go again, Michael Bay, who I guess I'm speaking to this purely from the stance of, I have become a lot more invested in the technical aspects of movie and learning about them, and sound has been a big part of that. And Michael Bay is a big reason for that, because whenever I listen to him talk about movies, for as much as people refer to him as like this Neanderthal, like he's really smart. Like he gets really excited and really intricate about the technical aspects of his movie, including sound. And the sound of his movies are very complicated. The way sound is designed and structured, the things you hear when certain things are happening, like to me, his movies and lots of other people's movies like have very complicated sound designs in that way. And that's kind of my reaction to a lot of what you're saying is like, yeah, I'm not knocking the contrast that this movie has. I just like don't understand why we're so fascinated by this and not fascinated by what all these other movies are doing.
And I would just say it's the way in which it's employed. Like, I don't think anybody's saying that other movies don't have good sound design, or that the sound design, or don't laud other movies for their sound design. Like, I feel like a lot of major blockbusters, that's one of the things that people praise. I remember with the Transformer movies, people calling out that the sound design was like really cool, the way in which like Michael Bay brought that transforming aspect to life, not just visually, but through the sounds that we hear. But I think it's specifically in setting up this idea of the levels of where the sound is coming from. Like, in photography, they talk about the use of foreground, midground, and background. And that's what gives a photo depth. It's not like you don't have good photos that are all foreground, good photos that are all midground, or good photos that are all background, or like a mix. But there's something about the contrast between use of foreground and background, or midground in comparison to the other two, and the dynamic between all of them, that can earn a photo or even cinematography in a movie a lot more praise and acclaim. So I would say in sound design, it's kind of similar. I think for the most part, most movies operate in a very foreground driven sound design. To what you're hearing is mostly what's immediately present. And that's not to say that there aren't movies that make great use of like ambient noise and background noise. Like, I'm thinking about some of the sound design choices in Blade Runner, for example, where the city feels so much more alive because of the bits of traffic that you're hearing, the advertisements that you're hearing, and the swish of lights and everything that kind of add to the ambience of everything. But specifically with Zone of Interest, there's just a different dynamic to the use of foreground and background and the interplay between them that is obvious, as you said, and like kind of straightforward and simple. But at the same time, it's not something that you get a lot of. So even though you get a lot of good sound design, I don't think this dynamic between foreground and background noise and the meaning of it and the thematics of it and the literary aspects of it that get brought to the forefront is made so pointed in films. Like, you might have a scene in a movie that is using background noise in a very interesting way, but I don't know if you have something that's so grounded to where the movie starts with 3 minutes of black screen to make people kind of prime them for to pay attention to the soundscape. So when it moves into everything, they're paying attention to a lot of the background noise.
Yeah. Everything you're saying is like, you're totally right. I feel kind of dumb for dragging us down this trail. Like, I'm not really trying to rag on the sound design of the movie. I feel like I brought up Michael Bay, which was my fault, and like that led us down a road. And I've got a lot of pent up aggression about people's hate towards Michael Bay, and that took down some other roads I'm not proud of. So like, here we are. But I agree with everything you said. Like, that's all very true about this movie. And in that way, again, I liked it as like thinking about it as this art installation piece. Like, the sound would be an important part of that, and it would be very pointed and specific, and you would know how you're supposed to feel about the sound. Like, those aren't bad things for a movie to do at all. So I take back everything I said. But I get wrapped up in the public reaction to things, and I shouldn't. That's very stupid.
I mean, the same thing happens with me. I get mad at when people like Argo. Like, that shouldn't be a thing. Like, I should not have a viscerally angry reaction to the fact that someone might enjoy Argo. Like, that should not be a problem. I feel the same way about Air. Air is a perfectly harmless movie. But it was the fact that people started talking about it as being a potential Best Picture winner. Or, like, it should get nominated for Best Picture, where it's just like, no, I will take every opportunity to tear Air down just because a few people on the internet made it a bigger deal than what it was.
Wow. I just watched Air. I really hated that movie.
It's so superficial. It's so I read a lot of nonfiction books, and productivity books are one of the ones that are really fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. But not just productivity, but like cognitive behavior aspects, you know, the whole Malcolm Gladwell kind of these are the things that drive us that we don't really realize kind of thing. So the Malcolm Gladwell books, Power of Habit is another good one. Willpower is this really interesting one about the neuroscience of willpower. We had a period, especially after Tipping Point, from that 2003, I think Tipping Point came out, or 2005 to, I want to say 2015, 2016, where you had these really thoughtful, well-researched nonfiction books. Mm-hmm. But in the age of where we're at now, especially with how many people have risen up into this genre as I'm going to become like a guru of this, or I'm going to publish a bunch of books in this vein because I know that it's a popular field, you have a lot of quick hits now that feel very throwaway. Like there was one book that I had read that was supposed to be talking about some aspect of, let's see, scrolling down, Better Than Before. And it's getting into some kind of like psychology of like improvements, but it's just all anecdotal things. Like I talked to my sister's brother, so her brother, but I talked to like my sibling, and she didn't know what to do when she changed jobs, and then she tried this and it worked for her. And that's the level of insight and analysis and research that you're getting is right. Just a few stories of like, my landlord wasn't always a landlord, he was actually a like reporter for the New York Times and decided one day, you know what, I'm gonna change. And you're like, why? Like, this is not a good anecdotal. Like, you don't want anecdotes like this. You want research. You want something that's thoughtful. And so many of the books that are in that vein now are really superficial in that aspect. And I forgot the point that I was going to tie this to.
It was fascinating nonetheless.
Where were we at? Oh, yeah. Air. I feel like Air is in that vein of
terrible?
A movie.
Yes, I agree.
That is very, very, like, I'm going to have the presentation of a deeper, more thoughtful movie, but we're just doing the most superficial bare minimum that we can do.
But really, I'm going to pussyfoot and meander around for 2 hours.
Yeah, it was so, like, it was so bullshit. Like, every beat was bullshit. Like, the few times they tried to develop characters, like
just ragging on air at this point,
my like, I'm missing my like wife and kids right now. It's just like, oh, you mean the characters that you didn't introduce and didn't build up at all, and now you're just throwing in for a little bit of character development that's completely unearned.
Ostensibly this movie is positing, and this is the dramatic thrust of the movie, what we're supposed to care about is this historic sneaker deal happens. And the interesting story does not belong to Michael Jordan or his mother or all of the people he benefited when they made this deal happen. But the other side of the table, the boring boardroom meetings and conversations, office linguistics that happened in preparation for this from a guy who kind of seems to care about what he does, but not really at all, and never really gives a reason for why he thinks Michael Jordan is the one. It's just kind of a movie that never really makes the effort to make you care at all, even a little bit, about the corporate perspective of selling a bunch of sneakers.
No. No. Especially compared to something like BlackBerry, where you're like,
BlackBerry's you saw BlackBerry?
I saw BlackBerry.
Okay. It was good?
It was pretty good. It's like...
better than Air?
Yeah. So if you have Social Network on one end of the spectrum of like corporate movies that are good and interesting, and Air on the other end of the spectrum of corporate movies that are superficial and
bad and uninteresting.
Yeah. BlackBerry is like firmly in the middle ground.
Okay. It seems like it is.
It's not as like good as Social Network, but it's trying to be.
It's not as
and
biting.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay. We both hit Air. That's good to know.
Yeah, so I get it. I wonder how you would have felt if you saw this movie, you know, in January ahead of all of the conversation, ahead of like all the praise. If you would have been ahead of it all rather than coming into it. I mean, I don't think it would change a lot of your feelings on it, but I do wonder if it would change at least some of the frame, like the frame of sitting down to watch it.
Right. It's definitely a mix, because everything I've expressed, like, I would have still felt, you know, just purely judging this movie as I do, like, I'm looking at all the pieces the movie has and how it's artistically conveying its point. Like, I would have recognized all the things it's doing and probably had similar reactions. The trap I followed into is listening to anybody else at all and, like, caring about the narrative around the movie. And, you know, none of that, honestly, and I fought this for a little bit. I had to remind myself that, like, that stuff doesn't really matter to me and doesn't ultimately matter when I go to rank the movie, which we're about to do. Like, I actually did like the movie. Like, there are things it did that I think it could have done better, for sure. But I like the point the movie's making. I like the style of cinema. I wish more people did it. I guess Lav Diaz kind of does it. I was thinking of the Toronto International Film Festival, where we saw Under the Skin and we also saw Norte. What's it called?
Norte, The End of History, which is the hardest title.
But yeah, it's just like a lot of like long shots of people just going about their business. It's I've always really been fascinated by the style of filmmaking, and wish more people did it. So on that level, like, I enjoyed this movie.
Well, that's good. I'm disappointed that it didn't blow you away, but I'm glad that it's did better than Tar.
Well, yeah, definitely. A part of it too is I just wish, that's not true, because I like to read about filmmakers and I want to hear them talk about movies and get their perspective and everything. But if I hadn't heard Jonathan Glazer like say the things he said, and if I hadn't known about a lot of the reactions to this movie, and I just like taken in the movie and purely seen it from the perspective of like people every day don't really pay attention to this kind of stuff, I think the movie's powerful. I think the larger point being tied to like these big, massive evil forces doing great harm, like, I just have a lot of trouble making a connection like to that as well. And I think that kind of, that to me reduces the movie's meaning a little bit, like dilutes it a little bit and makes it about something it isn't doing, at least effectively well, like it, with say aesthetic and everything. But the pure simple point to make the movie's making, the kind of art installation aspect of the movie, like, what's it doing, how is it making us feel in it, it does that really well, and I like that of it.
The point about like the larger
evil
forces, could you elaborate on that? Because that wasn't something, I know we mentioned it like a little earlier, but I view it as very much on that like art piece individual level, and that it's just kind of suggesting that these individuals that we see, or this like part of the human condition, is what then like allows for something to scale, rather than maybe trying to make a point about larger forces of evil. I'm just curious if you could.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a lot of articles about it. You know, someone from the New Yorker or whatever writes about the zone of interest. Like, I think that's been a narrative. Like, I saw a quote from someone at PBS. I saw a quote from someone. Where was it? It's just a very liberal talking point. I'm saying this as a liberal, by the way. Like, I don't give a shit about liberal talking points, but I just mean like sometimes a movie is kind of co-opted for a point. And I think to an extent, Glazer's speech at the Oscars kind of gets at it, like at least creating a parallel with what's happening now, you know, in Israel and everything. And I just think there is a somewhat like, there's just some intent to like tie it to that and show that like these things are still happening, which I don't think is the movie's point. Like, if the movie's point is to be about like the social circumstances that allow these things to happen, like that's a very different discussion than like we have the ability to ignore horrible things that happen. Like, that to me is a powerful point that the movie does well, but connecting it to this bigger thing, I think, is strange.
I mean, I don't think, especially like people that have made the connection between like Israel and Gaza in this movie, specifically because Glazer's comment, I think Glazer's comment was trying to say more about the fact that he's trying to make the movie to remind people that we still have this capacity for to be aware of that the what happened at the Holocaust wasn't just a one of in the past, that there's a human there's part of the human condition that allows for larger things to happen, and he's exploring what that mechanism is and positing that part of it is our ability to change our interest and disconnect from some of these things. But the movie obviously wasn't made with the intention of talking about Israel-Gaza stuff, because not saying that you were saying that, but I've seen people talking about that, because it wasn't going on at this level when he was working on this movie in 2016, 2015. Obviously, there have been bad tensions that have existed in like between the two for decades, but it wasn't like what's going on now wasn't the intention of the movie. And a lot of people have tried to, especially in the aftermath of Glazer's speech,
right,
make that connection. And I think he was trying to say that I made the movie to talk about now, like present day, in our capacity to be aware of like what we do and don't do and can do and can't do on like the individual level, and tying that into the fact of how Israel and Gaza, like Israel and Palestine, has been talked about or not talked about by some. But I don't think the movie itself is trying to get into larger events like that. I think it's really interested on that individual human like level, which is why it stays so grounded, aside from near the end when he goes off to work the new job, and you're seeing these meetings and seeing that everybody that's part of it is just taking it so very matter-of-factly. And you can imagine each of them is doing in their own way the same kind of thing that we've seen him do.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably ultimately right that Jonathan Glazer does understand like what the movie is specifically about. And maybe it's just more of that general Riddick that has made ties to Israel. And like, I think even, you know, in the Oscar speech itself, but I thought I read somewhere else him talking about Israel and how like, you know, this is a reminder. So you're right that it's probably more that what he's trying to say is along the lines of what everything you've just said, and less tied to the politicization that's happened generally with people in reaction to this movie and them drawing parallels. So that could be more of what my reactions to. So again, I'm trying not to like let that affect my view of the movie too much, because I know what the movie's about. I know why the movie works. Like, I'm just going to enjoy it on that level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a better way.
Yeah.
But I think if I was reading what people were saying about it, I would get very aggravated. I mean, it's just happened today. I was talking No Country for Old Men with somebody, and they were telling me that the movie's not supposed to be taken, like the old age aspect isn't supposed to be taken literally, and that it comes from like a Yeats poem about Yeats is like old age, and that's not really about old age, it's about like art and reality. And it's like, art and reality are definitely like part of the Yeats poem, but he was very old and also writing about old age. Like,
right.
And as much as you can get into the philosophical aspects of No Country for Old Men, age is still very much it's like a factor. You can't just ignore it.
Yeah.
But if that person were to write an article that I read, I would just be fuming. Well, did you have a favorite scene?
I do really like the, you know, the part where he pukes in the hallway or like thinks he's gonna puke. I had a weird reaction to that scene. Like, I don't think this is the way you're supposed to read the scene at all, but like, I had a moment of like, is this supposed to be funny? Because it's kind of funny that this guy is like, it almost feels like the filmmaker punishing this guy a little bit, like making him revolt at the but done in this like very like over the top, like, oh my God, I've been trying to ignore everything I've done, but like, I'm going to puke because I've killed millions of people or thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people. It just felt like in another movie. The movie is so serious and slow all the way through that, like, to me, it almost felt like a punchline at the end. But I could see another like comedy using that exact kind of moment to make its point.
He did say that he viewed it as the body rebelling in some way, that even if he can disassociate from what's going on, that there's some part of the body that knows.
Right.
And that would explain why he was at the doctor earlier thinking that something was wrong with him.
Right. Yeah.
Is like he's the body's saying like something's wrong, but he's continually ignoring it. I feel like it's the same thing with the dog in the movie, that we see the dog is so stressed out the entire time. And part of that is like the people aren't paying attention to him that much. Mm-hmm. It's just like, pet the dog, be nice to the dog. But you also have to think about the connection between like animals and human emotion, and the fact that the dog's hearing all of this shit all the time and is probably reacting a lot more naturally and viscerally than what the people are allowing themselves to react.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, there was a bit of like Deus Ex Machina about it, almost. Like the author coming in and being like, hey, you're gonna feel like, I'm just gonna like prick you a little bit here.
Yeah, right.
For me, I really like the subplot with the Hedwig's mother visiting, and just seeing how like she's kind of into it at first, and being like, oh, well, you know, the woman I used to clean for, I wonder if she's over there, and this is a lovely place. But that even she starts to get so creeped out by it, and the scene where she can't sleep because of the red light and the sounds is mm-hmm. such a, I think, a good externalization of the internal conflict she would have been going through, that when she leaves in the morning, it's such a like a nice little short story to me.
Yeah.
About this is how somebody should feel and do, and it highlights even further how kind of like intensely Hedwig is holding on to this life, and the fact that he's like, oh yeah, we can move, and she refuses, that she picks that place over maintaining like a life with her husband, just because it gets at so many kind of thematic things to me about like superficiality and putting material possessions over like humanity, and there's just a lot of interesting literary doors that opens.
Yeah, I like that.
Mm. Okay.
Similar rankings? Exploration with the kids as well, like just watching how they change over the course, and the brother shoving the other brother into the greenhouse and pretending it's a burn chamber. It's the kind of scene that would hits as hard as it does just because of like everything you've seen them doing the whole time, and like just being kids and like trying to ignore all of the horror going on outside, and then to see them just kind of like enacting it in a playful manner was pretty fucked up.
Yeah, very much so. It's one of those things that you're like, oh, maybe they'll be okay, and then you see that and you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
Not okay.
All right, yeah, rankings. What do we got?
Okay. Well, no surprise on my end. I have it in the top category, my favorites. there's 21 movies in that category right now, and it's alphabetical within the categories. So it comes in at 19, but that's just because there's 5 T movies.
Nice.
4 or 5. Yeah. And the sandwich is The Princess Bride, The Wailing, Zone of Interest, There Will Be Blood, and Too Late. Which, Too Late. I feel like nobody's ever watched Too Late. It's a film I saw at Fantastic Fest in 2015.
Yeah.
Or 2014? 2015. And it's, you would hate it. It's four long shots or long takes of like 20 minutes each. And it's, what's his name? John Hawks?
John Hawks, yeah.
John Hawks as a private eye trying to find a girl who's gone missing. And he's like trying to follow up on a lead. Well, the first scene has like a girl going missing, and the second scene is Hawks trying to bring the guy in, and you find out more about his life. But each scene is just like 20 minutes, no cuts. And it's really inventive camera work. It's bold in the like how much they're doing. I think the third one has a location change as well, which is pretty awesome to see how they handle that. It's a really fascinating movie. I got to see it in theaters a few months ago. They replayed it at the Alamo Drafthouse, and the director was actually there, which was cool.
Cool. For the record, I do not have a problem with long shots. I have a problem with long shots that are gimmicky. And
I mean,
don't add power to what it, you know, what it's portraying.
It's kind of gimmicky. There's no reason for it to be a long shot, but well, I really like it because I like the immersion.
Yeah, well, sometimes there are atmospheric reasons for it, maybe not a blatant like thematic reason, but like purely steeping you in it. And on that level, again, it can feel gimmicky sometimes if it's just not done well, if it's not fascinating enough, you know.
Yeah, but I would actually love for you to watch Too Late.
Some of my favorite movies have long takes. I already talked about some of the experimental filmmakers that I think Glazer's probably inspired by, especially Chantal Ackerman, and Gene Dielman has a ton of scenes like that. Although I don't love that movie as much as everyone else, but I do love News from Home, and that movie is just nothing but a bunch of static takes of nothing happening. So, yeah, I would watch it.
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime.
All right. So for my movie sandwich, I have The Zone of Interest in the good category, in the category of a bunch of other good movies. I have it, it'll sound low, but I have it ranked at 420 out of 572.
Yeah, that's a direct challenge to me.
It's just where it's at. It's around movies I like. The movie sandwich is Home for the Holidays, best Thanksgiving movie ever. Maybe not the best, but one of the best. Then The Last Dance, which is like Juzo Itami. He's a Japanese filmmaker and made some of my favorite movies. And this is a good one. It's a comedy set at a funeral. I don't know why funerals are such a good place for comedies, apparently. I don't know why that's a thing, but it is, and it works. Then The Zone of Interest. Then A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge. And then 12 Pups of Christmas, which is how did this get made style movie, which is just like so fucking bonkers that how can you not enjoy it?
Fittingly, as you're naming these movies around Zone of Interest, thunder is cracking in the background here.
I'm proud to make thunder crack.
What a sandwich, Travis. What a sandwich.
And for my 2023 rankings, I have it at number 34.
My 2023 rankings, it would be at number one.
Oh, nice.
You jerk.
Above Zone of Interest, by the way, just to make you even madder, I have May December, Robots, The Pope's Exorcist, 80 for Brady.
You have 80 for Brady? You would.
Yeah, it's an enjoyable movie.
You would. All right. What's next?
Well, I don't know when our next episode's going to be, because you're about to go on a vacation, so there's nothing next weekend. I'm probably going to have another baby in that time. So should I pick another movie for like the distant future?
You can pick it, and we'll see if things change by the time we're getting to it.
What's a good one?
What is a good one? I don't know anymore.
Yeah, you definitely don't. I'm like, I almost want to look at my movies and see if there's a 4K I haven't watched that I would.
Do you have the Lawrence of Arabia 4K?
Dude, you want to do Lawrence of Arabia?
Yeah, I've never watched it.
Let's do it.
Okay.
You'll probably have like a month to watch it.
Okay, perfect. It takes about a month to watch, right?
Yeah, about one.
Okay, perfect.
Maybe two.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to do the sign-off. This might be our last sign-off for a while, Chris. So
yeah.
We really need to nail it.
Okay, fine.
Okay, you ready for this?
Sure.
Okay. Lights?
Camera.
Action. Oh, shoot. Sorry. I went too fast.
You son of a...
Oh, wait. I said action. We got to say see. Hold on. Okay. Let's go back. Okay. Lights?
Lights.
Wait. No. You're supposed to say camera.
Sure.
All right. See ya.
Turn holiday travel from stressful to rewarding. Rakuten helps you save big on travel. They give you cash back when you book with sites like Expedia, Best Western, and Hertz. Even better, you can stack cash back on top of other rewards, like airline miles, credit card points, and hotel loyalty programs. Rakuten partners with over 3,700 stores, including Away Luggage, Ray-Ban, and Macy's, so you can be prepared with all the travel essentials and, of course, cute fits for your trip. Keep the rewards going with cash back on holiday gifts for friends and family. With Rakuten, you'll never miss out on savings at your favorite stores. The stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Join for free and start your shopping at Rakuten.com or use the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.